Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And you are welcome along to the special Halloween Day edition of the Hoddle Breakdown, where neither of us had the respect for the holiday to get dressed up, other than two kind of maybe chubby, slightly balding middle-aged Celtic supporters. Is that what we're going at as to our Halloween day today? Alan, I don't know about you. That's what I'm going as, apparently.
That's my costume. Yeah, I've covered up the handsome, good-looking one with a fat middle-aged balding bloke look. It's always a winner that at Halloween.
Yeah, always a crowd pleaser in my household as well. James here hosting, my good friend Alan Morrison from Celtic by Numbers. I think Celtic got in costume in this past week too. I think they went as the Batman villain, Two-Face. So between Wednesday last week and the game against Hibs, my goodness, from just a handsome devil to an ugly villain within the span of 3 days. So yeah, we're gonna review that glorious display of footballing excellence and entertainment on the weekend, and then we'll look ahead a little bit to tomorrow's game against St. Mirren. Alan, what's your kind of high level take on the performance and result from the weekend, and then we'll kind of dig in with some very meaty issues that I think are going to come out of the conversation.
Yeah, I think so. Just to tee up, what I would like to get into is just thinking about what Rodgers said before the game about in response to a question about, you know, his team were the, I can't remember the exact quotes of, I didn't have time to go and look at it, but it was roughly along the lines of, you know, would the team be tired after the exertions in midweek, and would you be looking to sort of rotate the squad, etc.? And Rodgers gave a very bullish, quite spiky actually answer to that, and then picked the same team. So I want to get into that a little bit, what the impact of that was, use of the substitutes, etc., which got mixed reactions, I think, from what I can see across the Celtic sphere. This was a game where Celtic have got a terrible record at Easter Road, right? And this was yet another. And again, I haven't had time yet to dig into that record at Easter Road and see what the sort of trends are. Because, you know, losing 4 goals in a game when the league's won is a little bit different to, is a specific context. Coming off the back of playing a really, really top side and giving everything on the pitch in that game is another context. So all these things are important. So, but nevertheless, we do seem to have an awful record. I think it's 2-12 now. We've won at Easter Road, which is, but in the context of Scottish football, it's possibly our hardest away game of the season, actually. It wasn't great from a creativity point of view. It wasn't great from an entertainment point of view. So, but yeah, I think there's a lot of things to get into in terms of the team that was picked and the subs that were used.
Yeah, again, just from a statistical perspective, kind of your normal Celtic dominating possession. I think the part that was alarming to me quickly was, and I mean alarming in the sense of, oh boy, maybe we have another relatively competent manager to confront in the league, is he set up, he seemed to learn maybe from their experience at Ibrox, and I think he their manager looked like he maybe applied some lessons from that experience and set up pretty defensively. And almost, you know, as I worry about chronically, is these that next tier of quality in the league, kind of the Hibs, Hearts, Aberdeen, playing that more pragmatic defensive counterattacking, particularly at home, at their home grounds against us, playing for the nil-nil pretty much. And that looks to me like how they set up and did a pretty good job of it. They're pretty well organized and tough to break down. And, you know, as we've talked about in recent weeks, that's a point of concern that we've had as far as creative play out of the wing positions. And for the first hour, basically, there wasn't much in the game. I mean, it was, even from an XG perspective, shots, I mean, it was not, you know, it was like Chinese water torture from an entertainment perspective. And then the subs actually brought a little bit to the game. And what are your thoughts there? I know you've done a little bit of work on looking at the creativity and how things went. And let's obviously, you know, we'll talk about the injury part too, because I think they probably changed the game to a degree as well. But what are your thoughts on how the subs and the performance levels kind of progressed?
Yeah, so I was very keen to look at the play of the wingers. This is something which I think was flagged up earlier in the season, that, you know, without Jota, without Abada, without the sort of balance of Jota and Maeda giving different problems to a defence, we've really been lacking, I think, this season in terms of wing play. And this was probably the worst example, or the best example, whatever you want to say, of that phenomenon. But I think, again, within the context of, you know, Rodgers gave a very spiky response to the fact that, oh, these are professional players. This is what it takes to play for Celtic. You play twice a week. They're all hard games. Get on with it, type of thing, was more or less his response to the question that I teed up earlier. And then, he played exactly the same team that finished the, you know, well, it's essentially, you know, Bernardo replaced Hatate. Otherwise, it was the same team that started in midweek. But all the evidence up to, as you say, up to when the second half subs came on, was that this was an incredibly tired team. Because, and how does that manifest itself? It manifests itself in, I think there's a couple of things happening. So you've replaced a high risk taker in Hatate with a player in Bernardo that I don't think we really understand what he is yet, but he looks to be quite strong defensively. And we haven't seen a lot of his kind of creativity yet. And he certainly hasn't been taking much risk in his passing or getting, even though he was the most forward of the three central midfielders and effectively replaced Hatate in that role, supporting Kyogo. We didn't see a lot of him in that sense. So you're kind of one down in terms of you've taken out somebody who can do unexpected things like Hatate can, that open up defences, and replace them with somebody who looks to be incredibly competent in some of the skills that Matt O'Reilly's got, which are pressing, closing down the opposition, being quite athletic, which is what we've been calling for. But, you know, this is a really delicate balance. So therefore, the onus really in terms of attacking creativity, chances, then falls to the wide players. And so what I did during the game was I actually documented every on-ball action that both wide players played. Now, I've not quantified this, I've not put any numbers around it yet, but I'm going to write it all up. But just to tee that analysis up, really, is that a couple of things. So one is that Maeda got on the ball probably half as much as Palmer did. And I'm just looking back through Maeda's on-ball actions, and there was, I think, one, two pack passes out of all of his actions, and the rest were either passes backwards, forward passes that didn't really progress that much, one shot at goal, a couple of square passes, one failed take on or dribble, one cross that didn't make it into the box, and otherwise it's all passing backwards or losing the ball. And then we look at Palmer. Palmer was far more involved in the game. Scales in particular did a good job of finding Palmer wide on the left. And again, he actually had the highest XG of any player on the pitch, but none of them were significant chances. They were all long shots from outside the box or even wider than the box. And again, I'll document this and I'll try and sort of quantify it. But essentially, it's a story of either losing the ball in the final third without doing anything with it or passing backwards. And so essentially, Celtic got very little really in terms of, attacking threat from their wide players. I think the overall, I do a attacking threat score. So somebody like an Edouard, for example, just use that as a benchmark, for example. Edouard would average around about 9 to 10 this attacking threat score in a game. So Maeda had like 3 and Palmer had like 4. So pretty low scores, really. You're looking at Palmer, 4 shots on target, 4 shots off target, none on target. Maeda had the one sort of big chance of the game that fell to him. Maeda didn't create a single chance. Palmer created one chance in the whole game. So a real deficit of, but not just outcome and output from the wide players. It was intent. It was, there were occasions where Scales or Taylor would pass to Palmer and they'd actually take out the whole midfield and the two forwards, and therefore Palmer would be one-on-one with the fullback. And he virtually never took him on. The only time that they got beyond the fullback was if Taylor overlapped. Otherwise, it never happened. Same with Maeda. So you had two fullbacks essentially just turned in and came back again constantly. Now, as you said, this is again cognitive dissonance amongst the Celtic support. There was general, derision almost when we end the game with Turnbull, Johnston, Mikey Johnston, and James Forrest. James Forrest, as the sort of attacking creative players. But the reality was, as James said, it was 50-50, very little. Celtic hadn't touched the ball in Hibbs's penalty box until Forrest and Turnbull came on. Celtic had not touched the ball in Hibbs's box in the second half, right? They'd barely even lost the ball in the final third because they never even got there. So, yeah, the substitutes actually completely changed the game. And if you look at Forrest and Johnston, people tend to remember Forrest hitting the bar, missing a good chance, Johnston wildly shooting, giving the ball away a couple of times, dribbling the ball out of play, because that backs up your kind of... But if you actually look at it, every time Johnston got the ball, what did he do? He went forward. He took the game forward, which Celtic hadn't done hitherto in that match at all. His final delivery, his final pass wasn't great, but he had quite a number of pack passes. He at least attempted a number of shots. He got into the box, him and Forrest got into the box more than any other, opposition box more than any other player. Forrest got in 6 times, Turnbull and Johnston got in 4, and that was it, O'Reilly 3. So they completely took the game to Hibs. I know Hibs were probably tiring at that point, you could argue, and that definitely is a factor. It's easy to be wise after the event and all that. But all of this, and I know that the outcome wasn't there and Celtic didn't score, but actually there's an argument to be made, I think, that should Rodgers have actually started with quite a refreshed team? Because to me, as much as you might not have liked some of the end product of Forrest and Johnston, they at least drove forward and they at least got into the box and they at least made things happen. They at least tried to push Hibs back, which hadn't happened, virtually hadn't happened at all in the preceding 60 minutes. And similarly, you know, would a Turnbull have been more more effective than a Bernardo in that game, given Bernardo's hadn't started, never played that intensity of game before against that sort of level of opposition? Again, easy to be smart after the event, but it just struck me that, you know, the subs made such a difference, and yet the reaction amongst a lot of Celtic fans was so negative because of who the subs were. But actually, if you look at what happened, it was a massive improvement.
Yeah, it was. It's one of those games, I think, where the longer it stays 0-0 and how horrible the entertainment value or lack thereof was, that you get this cascading exponential rise in disgust by the point where whoever comes on as a sub, unless they pull the game out, it's almost, you know, they're going to end up with getting slaughtered from a sentiment perspective. And to your point, I think there's such anchored views on those players at this point. I mean, Forrest, we've always talked about the dichotomy with him and how long he's been dealing with, you know, initial kind of anchoring from when he was a young player. And I mean, Mikey Johnston, I think you might even admit, I certainly still have my biases towards him just because of the how abject some of his decision-making's been. And we've talked about that over the years too. So yeah, we're certainly not claiming immunity to these kind of impulses, but yeah, there are certain events that take place in a game that, particularly when people have kind of an anchored bias, that just, you know, inflame it. And Johnston committed one of them, which is just dribbling the ball out. So forget about it right there. That's going to be a big problem. And then the second one is when people just pass the ball out, you know, just right out of play, and there's a miscommunication or, you know, missed vision in sight of the teammate. So yeah, I actually thought, you know, there was, even watching the game, I noticed a different energy and picking up. And so let's, you know, transition then to talk about the impact of, you know, it's certainly not a topic I want to keep returning to, but we have to because it keeps happening. The news with Hatate out at least to Christmas or after Christmas, I think Roger said yesterday. To me, that, and had a follower tweet me yesterday about the collagen comment, I joked with him that I thought that's what I have in my butt implant. I thought that was like something that people put lip implants in, and when you want that big round tushy that people get implants for these days. But yeah, Roger's talking about collagen levels, and to me that speaks of a tear of a tendon, a hamstring tear, which again is something that Kyogo suffered under Ange and had to have surgery and was out 3 to 4 months. And as I keep saying, since, you know, the announcement of Roger's return back in June, any of these as a one-off, you know, it's not surprising that these kind of players have soft tissue injuries. But you can't just take it in isolation, and it has to be put in a broader context. And to me, you know, Johnston being allowed to return to the pitch in that game was so ridiculous, such an abject failure of, you know, just simple duty of care. I mean, I said to you, Alan, before we went live, I mean, I'm just some dopey guy in the suburbs that got asked to help assistant coach a U12 rec soccer team a few years back. And I underwent training for mandatory training for concussion protocols, that there is no way in heck that I as an assistant coach would have allowed any player to return based off of the trauma incident and the symptoms that he was displaying and how he was behaving afterwards. So it's just, once again, I mean, it at what point do you just throw your hands up and say, what the heck is going on here from a sports science and a health perspective as far as how these players are being taken care of? And, you know, I keep coming back to this issue of culture, which is, I just, that's why I go back to this Johnson issue, which is you can't allow players that are concussed to make the decision to go back onto the pitch. I mean, it's that's nuts.
If any player on that pitch is going to insist
upside down, it makes no sense.
Yeah, if any player on the pitch is going to insist he's going to go back on the on that field, it's going to be Alistair Johnson.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's, you know, this goes back to the tyranny stuff that I've cited in the past, and you know how Kyogo was allowed to basically sever his hamstring, and so I have no idea. Maybe Hatate does have a genetic thing, or you know, maybe there's something going on here relative to his specific incident and his body and health. But again, the pattern here is just, and you know, this is where I talked about repeatedly in recent weeks about the stacking of risks and the recruitment window being not as good as we had hoped. Now the squad depth, and now you have another bout of injuries here. And I shared an article, you know, again, I'll get my cross sports reference in. There's a first baseman for the Yankees named Anthony Rizzo who experienced the trauma event back in, I think it was April or maybe early May, had passed all of the concussion protocols and, you know, was allowed to return after, you know, not that long being out of the team, and then just performed dreadfully for months. And, you know, they had to go through another battery of tests to really identify that, oh, indeed he had a concussion and that he was still suffering from, you know, kind of the lingering effects of this stuff. So again, I have no idea what with Johnston, you know, who knows? I'm not, you know, someone trained in these things other than dopey youth football or soccer, but you know, what I do know, because I'm married to a doctor and this qualifies me just like in Larry David's show, Curb Your Enthusiasm, is, you know, allowing him to go back on the pitch like that makes that worse. Meaning that, you know.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The fact that he was not immediately removed and cared for, you know, can make all of this stuff worse. So, yeah, it's just now we're back to this cycle of potential injuries returning, and you know, midfield we're left with not a lot of depth there.
Well, there's certainly numbers, but we don't know what we've got. I think that's the problem. But I mean, you're coming back to the injuries. I think, you know, the Johnson thing, you know, had echoes of, I think, Lustig quite a few years ago, where he, you know, whoever it was, as you say, the decision should be taken out of the player's hands, right? If they've had a head knock like that, the doctors should really err on the side of caution and really remove them from the field. It's just ridiculous. It was obvious that he was in severe discomfort. And as you say, it's a cultural thing. The player's always going to want to play on. And, you know, if the doctors hide behind that as an excuse to let them carry on, then that's unforgivable. They need to, you know, they need to be very firm about, and as I say, even if it's an irritant to the manager, and they might seem okay, you've got to err on the side of caution when it comes to sort of welfare in that sense. The Hitati one, you know, he's now got a bit of a history of hamstring injuries. Now, I don't, again, I suppose the specifics around him are, one, I'm still a little bit perplexed as to how someone gets that degree of hamstring injury in the first minute of a game, right? Because that all to me makes me wonder about, you know, the quality of the warm up, etc., and the conditioning, and also, you know, what are we doing? Again, we come back to this predictive software. What are we doing to monitor these things, to spot weaknesses? And that, you know, and then the more broad issue is, how are we deciding that all the players that played on Wednesday night, what, you know, where's the, what are the KPIs? What are the stats that they're using? What is the intelligence that they're using to say, well, how, if 100% is match fit, no issues, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sure very few footballers are there, right? But, you know, where are they? Are they 80? Are they, say, 85? Or some of them, you know, there'll be different stories for different players, for sure. But to me, how are you? Is it just a matter of faith that you put the same players on the pitch, tell them they're playing for Celtic, and that you have two hard games a week and get on with it, and therefore they will play well? Well, clearly they won't. And I think, you know, the third thing that comes out of this for me, and this is going to be really tough for people to swallow, is that the reality of where we are today is that, you know, the likes of James Forrest and Mikey Johnson and David Turnbull, they're not that much worse if than the ones that we're picking in the first 11. There really isn't that much between them. And therefore, you know, if there's any significant doubt about match readiness, about conditioning, about fitness, etc., then, you know, swap them out. We've got a huge squad, as Rogers said, got a huge squad. Some of these players we haven't even seen yet, like at home, we've hardly seen any minutes from at all. You know, Tilio, I think, is only just back from injury, long-term injury, etc.
So I think Holmes just back from an injury now too. So he's... Yep, I think he had something for the last couple of weeks—a calf.
McGregor.
Yep.
Yeah, aside of probably McGregor, O'Reilly, you know, Carter Vickers, and Kyogo, that there aren't really. I would suggest there aren't any untouchables in that team, and therefore we, you know, again, being wise after the event, Rodgers probably didn't expect such a flat performance as that, but all the signs and the data are there, and it's all point to fatigue, lack of risk taking, lack of dynamism. All the pressing stats were way down, etc. So, what were you seeing during the week that convinced you that they were ready to give the same intensity as was, you know, as was displayed against Madrid, or at least close to, against Hibs away, which, as I say, is our hardest away ground. So for me, I think it's a real wake-up moment for the whole squad management. You know, we've played a virtually unpicked team. I don't know whether Rodgers feels that he's got a starting 11 and not much beyond that. I don't know, you know, but I think the reality is probably a bit more prosaic than that. As I say, aside from four players that we're probably going to risk burning out, we might as well rotate the squad and be as fresh as we can be, is my takeaway.
Yeah, I think that the... important context of this is, you know, part of what people that are involved in analysis and analytics do is ask questions, as I always talk about, you know, aligning the analysis with what question that's trying to be answered. And we're inherently, as outsiders, we're inherently left with an information deficit. So we're going to speculate, right? So the pattern here that we've laid out, about long-term, you know, injury record with Rodgers as a manager, the culture at Celtic, you know, those are kind of the mosaic. And so when we ask these questions, it's within that context, and admitting fully that we can't know really anything, but that, you know, it's the old smoke versus fire type of thing where you connect some dots and you know, legitimately, I think, ask the questions, which is what's going on here and, you know, what's being done. Because to me, it's, you know, as I went on a couple of times about the Tierney incident and situation and experience, is it's not only a question of, and I think there is some the culture aspect of that relative to duty of care, and that's evolved over time. And I think that, you know, increasingly it's more difficult, but I think reasonable people can disagree on where that line is, right? Where's the grin and bear it and play through some injuries versus, you know, where's that duty of care issue. But to me, you reach a certain point where it's just like asset management, people management stupidity, where you're, you know, you risk losing guys like Hatate for 4 months, you know, or like we did with Kyogo. And, you know, we're at the point now where if we lose Kyogo for 4 months, I mean, what? That's like league risking level of concentration of risk now with one player.
Yeah.
Where I would legitimately begin to fear, not like my normal paranoia because it's just there always, but, you know, like analytically, oh boy, we might lose the league now kind of paranoia. If we lose somebody like that for 4 months. So that's, you know, that's the level here of competitive impact, yeah, and asset management. And it's just, it's crazy.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, O'Reilly's soon going to get exhausted out of his sparkling form if he plays continues to play 90 minutes every single game.
McGregor, and the way that he's playing, because he's got,
yeah,
the,
exactly, board, it's all
he's
action,
got the pedal to the metal.
Yeah, it's all, yep, action. Yeah, yep. All action. He's all over the field. He covers McGregor and he breaks into the box. He's doing all that. McGregor himself, you know, his decline is well documented. It's a fact. And Carter Vickers has come back off a long injury. Kyogo's 28, had a bad hamstring injury. All these things are there. All these things are risks, absolutely. And, you know, again, what we're saying is, look, this is what the data says. This is what the patterns look like. Again, these are questions. You know, we don't know, as James says, but you want to see is good squad management, good duty of care, good sense of responsibility, really. So listen, I think this is, it's not just a sad, it's worth saying, as I keep saying when we have this conversation, this isn't just a Celtic thing. I suspect you see the same thing at virtually every professional football club, to be honest with you. But you know, we want our Celtic to be the best version of themselves all the time, which is, you know, part of the reason for this show. So we'll call it out in that sense. But in terms of, you know, back to the game, James, you know, I think again, it was one of these where we keep talking about XG differential, which I think is really important because it actually highlighted, it was the best indicator of Ange Ball in terms of its success in domestic terms. And we continue to actually linger a long way behind that level, which is a worry. And people scoff at these expected points tables, but they've worked well in the past. They're showing sort of almost parity at the top of the league at the moment. I know we've had the harder games. I know we don't get helped out with late penalties and all that stuff, but you know,
poor Enda. Did you see poor Enda? I mean, he's not here to defend himself, but he got, I think he got the Kerrydale Street meltdown anointment this week. And
all right, very good.
You didn't see that? Oh yeah, he went.
No,
viral.
No, I didn't see
that. Oh yeah, he went viral.
listen, you know, I think even Enda's recognizing there's a pattern. And by the way, just on that, you know, I'll cover that off quickly. You know, two penalties at Ibrox, both of them were penalties. Absolutely no doubt about that. No issue with that. But the point that people will deliberately miss is that, you know, think about what has revealed itself about the standard of refereeing in Scotland since VAR was brought in, right? And it, the same thing happened in many countries, but it kind of pulled the curtain back a little bit on the workings because you suddenly had more of them and you suddenly had more people making bad decisions. And, you know, how many poor decisions have there been in the league? And this is about a question of competence, right? So, you know, every single manager has probably got numerous horror stories in the league about this decision, that decision, this penalty, that penalty. Why didn't we get this? You see it every week. One week it might be Motherwell. Next week it might be Kilmarnock. Celtic went through a horrendous run when it first all came in. So you would think then that that almost proves the point that there's a level of incompetence operating here, and it seems to infect everybody in the league, except it doesn't, because there's one team that doesn't seem to suffer any jeopardy, doesn't seem to get that dodgy penalty against them, doesn't seem to get that rather harsh sending off that everyone else seems to get. That's the issue. So yes, there were penalties, but my God, they were always going to be given. There was never going to be a case of, oh, we missed that one. Oh, we're not sure about that. We're going to err on the side of caution and it's the last minute. Oh, that always happens in the box. I'll not give that one, right? None of that. So that's the issue. And that is the issue. And even dear old Ender has now spotted it.
And he was honored for it. So let's maybe we'll put a bookend to the Hibs game, and let's move on to looking forward to St. Mirren, who's been an interesting team so far this season. I've taken a look at them a little more closely in preparation for today. And they've been, let's call it, materially overperforming. So, and what I mean by that is they're scoring goals at a level that's significantly above what their chance creation would suggest. And again, we're talking about a relatively small number of games, so that's not abnormal. But it does indicate maybe that maybe the underlying fundamentals of their performance levels aren't quite in line with where they are in the table. Which, you know, is good and bad from my perspective, because again, I'm always hopeful of teams that show up at Celtic Park to maybe have a go. And I suspect that might not be the case with Mr. Robinson. He's a pretty good manager, within the context of the league, and, usually well organized, in looking at what they've been doing for the most part when they're away in particular, but when they're playing kind of top four or five wage bill teams, you know, the big Glasgow and Edinburgh clubs and Aberdeen, setting up kind of in a 5-4-1. Whereas when he's playing, you know, Dundee at home, he's going 3-4-3. So obviously that's fluid, but if you look at kind of where they're setting up defensively, average line and what metric defensive distance, I don't think they're going to park the bus in the sense, they're unlikely to park the bus in the sense of, you know, cratering completely around the 18, but I think, you know, they'll play kind of a mid block to more defensive and, you know, cover the wings and crowd the middle. They've, I think, smartly converted Gogic to a center back. He's been playing in the middle of the back three, which again, within the context of Scottish football, I think is a pretty athletic, decent pace, kind of strong, skillful guy playing that kind of position, decent in the air, that kind of thing. So I think they're going to be a challenge and an annoyance. And if we don't play much different or better than we did on the weekend, I could see another horrible 0-0. It's kind of a poor outcome. That should, you know, isn't the base case, shouldn't be the base case. You know, kind of generically, St. Mirren at home should be, you know, kind of the 2-0 baseline. But I could see the formula here based off of the blueprint from the weekend that we need to do a better job in multiple aspects in order to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just a couple of things. I agree with all that. Things I picked up about them is, you know, no team plays less passes in their own half. So they just do not play football in their own half at all. And they've actually got the highest long ball passing completion rate. So 15% of long balls that they attempt, they actually complete, which is the highest in the league, bizarrely. And the other interesting stat is that they've got the highest ratio of shots taken in the box, which suggests some smarts being applied. So what I mean by that is 79% of their attempts at goal occur within the box. That's 13% more than Celtic. So they're a team that, you know, but having said all that, as James said, rightly, they are massively overperforming their expected goals. Their expected goals are something like 1.67 per game. And actually they're scoring just over one a game. So, and on the other side of that, they've probably got the seventh best goal difference by expected goals, but they're comfortably third. So there's some overperformance there, but based on what we've said, there's also some method clearly in terms of certain philosophies that they're adhering to about, you know, not overplaying in their own half, trying to get as many, you know, shots taken in the box, perhaps not overdoing it in terms of shots outside the box, in terms of, you know, they know long balls are coming. They've got, you know, the likes of strikers that are good, expect it, know what they're doing as far as dealing with those long balls as well. And as we always say with St Mirren, they've got excellent midfield athleticism, which means that they can, you know, when there are long balls, they can, even if they're not winning the initial ball, they can often win the second ball. So, you know, but Celtic surely can't be exhausted a week after after Atletico Madrid again, and surely can't move the ball as slowly, and surely can't be as risk averse in terms of when the creative players get the ball in the final third, you know, not actually pushing the defence back, but actually trying to, you know, they surely can't be as conservative again. So, as always with these games, I expect Celtic, you know, there is a deficit there in terms of ability and so forth. But, you know, St Mirren, as we've said many times before, they have a plan and they do it very well, and fair play to them.
Yeah, I think to your point, you know, you combine the likelihood of a more disciplined, narrow defensive setup with the pragmatic approach to going long out of the back, meaning that that's going to, to a significant degree, you know, make our counter press and press less effective. And then their striker, he's a big dude. So he's like 6'2", 6'3", pretty athletic. So as far as an out ball, playing that, getting up the pitch with the second balls, that he'll probably create the chaos a decent amount. And again, this is going to come back to, I would be shocked if the strategy isn't launching those long balls to our defensive left into, you know, the triangle of basically Hart, Scales, and Taylor, down that side of the pitch. So yeah, it's
Tanzer, the guy, that lad that plays sort of left wing back or left back, left wing back, he's actually one of the most creative players outside the top two, and has been for a number of years. His delivery from the left is excellent. So again, not just from open play, but also set play as well. So he's definitely a threat. Yeah,
and this is one of those games where you can almost write the script as far as how the opponent's going to play. So the question is, you know, what do we do about it? And I think that'll be the litmus test in the short term, which is coming off of that game from the weekend. If anything, St. Mirren's likely to be even more the version of Hibs, of what Hibs was on the weekend. And you know, so that'll be interesting. So yeah, let's leave it there, and we move forward to the weekend. I think I didn't even look that far ahead. So, but we'll be back to talk about the weekend, preview that a little bit. I think on Friday is when we're looking to maybe reconvene with Mr. Famous, Mr. Viral, and Nicole.
The referee basher, yeah. The guy who wants to talk about referees all the time.
The conspiracy theorist, and Nicole. We'll return Friday. And, you know, hopefully we get to discuss passing the litmus test tomorrow with flying colors, and we break down their low block with four or five goals. So, as always, thank you for watching on those on YouTube. Go ahead and hit the subscribe button and comment below if you haven't already. Those on Spotify or Apple iTunes, if you can leave a review, that'd be great as well. And that's it for the holiday edition, or the Halloween edition of the Huddle Breakdown. Yes, and we will be back on Friday. So enjoy tomorrow's game, and we'll talk to you then.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.